And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. You described at one point in the book for part one of today's morning show, you're going to be hearing an interview which I recorded with best-selling author Mark Ball about his most recent book, which is called Meet Me in Atlantis. In this very, very intriguing book, he describes the many years which he has spent essentially in pursuit of the legendary lost city of Atlantis and encountered all kinds of other people who also found themselves in a sense, bitten by the same bug, so intrigued by the notion of that mystical city in fact existing that they have devoted all kinds of time and valuable resources to the pursuit of that elusive goal of finding tangible evidence that such a place as Atlantis actually existed. It's a very, very fascinating odyssey which he undertakes, and he writes about it so tellingly in this intriguing new book. Here is our interview. You described at one point in the book how Atlantis is a virus and that you had been exposed. Briefly tell our listeners how you were first exposed to the so-called Atlantis virus.
Well, what happened was I was assigned a magazine story to write about the greatest philosophers of all time. And after calling about 10 professors, every single one of them said the greatest philosopher of all time was Plato. So I started reading a little bit of Plato, and I came across again and again this piece of information I couldn't wrap my head around, which was that everything we know about Atlantis comes from two dialogues that Plato wrote around 360 BC.
And what was it about that that was so intriguing that you just couldn't shake it off?
Well, here on the one hand, we've got, you know, this sort of idea that's usually associated with crackpot ideas, you know, with Bigfoot and UFOs and things like that. And
or comic books.
Hand, exactly, and you know, Scrooge McDuck. And here on the other hand, we've got the greatest thinker in Western history. So the idea that those two places met somewhere in the world, I found absolutely fascinating.
Hmm. So there is this whole field, a growth industry, you call it, of Atlantology. And I suppose that, tied into what you just said, it is probably a really complicated landscape in which you indeed do have crackpots, but also people who do work on this with the utmost seriousness and in some cases even scientific criteria in mind. Just tell us about just how wide a range we're talking about in this universe of Atlantis explorers.
Well, you know, on the one end, you've got, people who follow psychic visions and, you know, believe that they lived in Atlantis in past lives. And on the other end, you've got serious scientists. As, you know, probably the most esteemed Atlantologist in the world is a fellow who's a geophysicist at one of the best universities in Greece, who's using all sorts of data to look for it. You know, one of the more interesting theories I found was a guy who took all of these details that Plato put in the Atlantis story, and there is a lot of specific detail, which is what makes the search for Atlantis so enticing. And, you know, he put it through a statistical analysis and figured out that Plato's Atlantis had been in Morocco. So, you know, there's all kinds of different levels of people looking for this.
Give us a rough idea of the kind of city that was described by Plato, and what makes that description so exceptionally compelling?
Well, Plato describes a maritime city that is shaped like three concentric rings of land and water. I think if anyone is ever going to actually find the original source for Atlantis, they're going to have to find those three concentric rings. It's a very militaristic society. They're at war with Athens. That's the actual story of Atlantis. They have this enormous plain behind the city where all the food is grown. They have this incredible system of canals. They have a large mountain range to the north that supposedly blocks these northerly winds. You know, he really gets into this sort of granular detail that makes you want to go out and look for this thing if you read the original story.
In the fourth chapter of the book, this is your search for various folks pursuing this takes you all over the world, actually. At this point in this chapter, I think you're somewhere in Ireland.
Yeah.
But at one point you mention that it's really difficult for anyone who is maybe a serious scientist or academic to raise serious questions about this because you're so often prone to ridicule. At one point you write, "I couldn't blame academics for being wary. Any online search for information about Atlantis quickly sucks one into a wormhole of conspiracy theories and magic portals to untapped dimensions." I'm sure that must have been both a complicating factor for you and also a source of endless fascination in the writing of this book.
Well, of course, you know, that sort of thinking is fascinating, but when you're trying to get, you know, actual academics and scholars on the phone, you have to hold off on using the A word at first because they'll just hang up on you. There were a lot of emails that went unanswered once people got around to the fact that I was talking about Atlantis. It just, for certain fields, it seems to be career kryptonite to even raise the topic because it's been, you know, tarnished by this association with crazy thinking.
In what way would you equate your escalating fascination with all of this as akin to what drives those who really believe there was an Atlantis and find this, feel this urge to somehow discover it or uncover yet undiscovered facts about it? I mean, in a sense, is their obsession and your obsession one and the same?
I think by the end they were pretty similar. We're both basically following the treasure map that Plato laid out and trying to get to that buried treasure. And, you know, by the end, you know, I come up with some conclusions based on what I think Plato was trying to do with this story. But, you know, when you look at all these details that he gives and you start to dig through it and try to find that original kernel of truth, it does become absolutely, obsessive. It just takes over your whole life at a certain point.
So what do you think is what is going on in the minds of particularly people who are otherwise serious and sane human beings who find themselves gripped with this this belief? And I guess I don't mean the people who also believe the world is flat or believe witches or whatever, but I mean those who are really serious about this. What is so intriguing about the notion of a place called Atlantis?
Well, you know, as one archaeologist explained to me, you know, Atlantis, we've come to believe it was some sort of utopia, and we project these, you know, whatever feelings we have onto this place. We think it was, you know, peaceful, or we think it was, you know, super sophisticated. I think for these people, it's just the idea of, like, solving a mystery. You know, perhaps the greatest mystery of all time. Was Atlantis real? And if it was, where was it located?
To that last question, let's just chat about that for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, we're giving serious thought to where is Atlantis located, when in fact there may not have ever been an Atlantis.
Very true.
But that being said, what are the current best estimates of where one might find the ruins of Atlantis if they existed?
I would say the original source of Plato's Atlantis was probably one of four places. It was probably either in southern Spain, just outside the Pillars of Hercules at Gibraltar there, or on the island of Malta, which is the oldest culture in the Mediterranean, has the oldest freestanding temples in the Mediterranean. There's an island off of Greece called Santorini, which has a sort of unique bullseye shape, which Plato says the city of Atlantis had. And then there's a spot on the Atlantic coast of Morocco near the city of Agadir, which, you know, according to a statistical analysis that this IT professional in Germany did, is like, he called it Seven Sigma, the way it measured up. The numbers were so good. So I would say it's probably one of those four places.
Do you find yourself, now you have written this book, with your thirst to know more about Atlantis quenched? Or in some ways, is this a virus that one never fully sheds?
You know, I don't think you could fully shed this virus until it were proven definitively either that Atlantis was fiction or that Plato had based it on an actual story. And I think it's more likely the latter, and I think that it's still possible that we'll come up with some new piece of evidence that will completely change the search for Atlantis.
In our last few seconds, tell our listeners about one of the many fascinating characters that you met on the road to this adventure.
Well, probably the most fascinating character I met on the road to Atlantis was Tony O'Connell, who operates an online encyclopedia called the Atlantipedia, out of his house in the least populated part of Ireland. Because no academics will take this seriously, Tony has become sort of a clearinghouse for all the ideas about Atlantis. And he's an arbitrator who gets to decide, you know, what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And he's kind of given his whole life over to this. He's a great guy.
Hmm. One of many memorable characters we meet in the pages of your fascinating book. Again, it's called Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City, published by Dutton. Mark Adams, congrats on a fascinating and very fun book.
Thank you very much.
It's 8:21. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here comes part two. We're getting older. That doesn't seem like particularly significant news, but let me explain further what I mean and how that relates to the book that we will be talking about. I mean that not only each of us, of course, as individuals are getting older, but that we as a country and indeed we as a planet are growing older. Our population is aging in incredibly dramatic fashion and in some ways far outstripping what previous expectations had been. And there are all kinds of ramifications about this, some very much beyond the obvious. And they are explored in a really interesting book called Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. The author is Ted Fishman, and perhaps you have seen his work in USA Today, New York Times Magazine, Money Magazine, Harper's, Esquire, and in many, many other places. He makes his home, actually, in Chicago. This book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm really glad that we have Ted Fishman with us for the next few minutes to talk about this very important book. Ted Fishman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much. You know, I was impressed with the distinction you made between how people age and how communities age. I think people are confused about this. People think that the world's getting older just because people are living longer. Of course, they are living longer. We live about twice as long as human beings did when the steam engine was invented. But it's really the lower birth rates around the world that are changing the age demographic and turning society upside down. And when you think about it that way, it's not hard to understand why all of our relationships are changing as the world ages.
Well, and one of the things that you say more than once in the book is that to a large extent, we seem to be very much caught off guard by this development, that somehow this is occurring at a rate that not too many people seem to have fully anticipated. I mean, certainly that's true of the general population. Someone like me, I have no particular reason to put all of this together. But even people who study such things seem not to be fully prepared for what these numbers are telling us.
I think so, and I think that because there's a few accelerating facts about global aging that people don't take into account when they make their calculations. You know, there are all these feedback loops. So if you think about why, for example, family size goes down, which ages the world, very often it's because of one of the great things that's happened in our world, which is that women can achieve their aspirations. They have opportunities for education and for careers that they've never had in history. And when they do that, they take time to educate themselves, and they take time to launch in their careers. And so even if they want larger families, their period for having children is far shorter than it's ever been before. And when they have smaller families, they put more resources into the fewer children they have. So if you just have one or two children, you can put all your family education money towards those one or two children. You could feed them better. You can house them better. And then once they're better educated, they are also more sophisticated urbanites, and they will have small families. And you can see this unfold around the world. So we know it's happened here. We know it's happened in Europe. But the places we turn to for young workers, like China, very soon go into this dynamic itself. So, you know, Mexico will be an older country than the United States before long, because it too is urbanizing, family size is shrinking, more family resources are going for the fewer children that are there, and you just get this rolling dynamic of globalization, which creates an aging population, which creates smarter, healthier children have fewer children. So, you know, with all of the scary things about an aging world, there is also this miracle, the aspirations of women, people living longer and healthier. And these are two things that are so great, we are unlikely to turn the clock back on either of them, but that means we won't turn the clock back on population aging either.
And, of course, we need to better understand what that means for all of us.
That's right. And, you know, think about it. We've been as brilliant as human beings can be about creating longer life. You know, we've created vast public health systems. We've defeated infectious disease. We may soon cure cancer and Alzheimer's. But we're still surprised when we get to the world where there are more older people. So we have to apply some of this genius to creating the best societies we can, too, with the miracle we've delivered to ourselves.
We're speaking with Ted Fishman. We're talking about his new book called Shock of Gray, which examines the ramifications on all kinds of different levels of our planet's population aging as dramatically as it is. In fact, is it possible to succinctly sum it up in numbers in terms of how much our planet's population has aged?
Sure, sure. Of course it is. Well, first of all, there is that lifespan that's expanded. So a lifetime now can be twice as long as the average lifetime at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and it's true even in developing countries, people are living longer. Family sizes are smaller, so people have fewer people to take care of them as they get old. And as you age, if you want a family member to take care of you, it could be your 85-year-old spouse or your 75-year-old child, and people tend not to want that, so they're craving social solutions for care for the elderly. People can work later in life, but sometimes they're not allowed to work later in life, and this is something we have to solve. And then there is this other fact, Greg, which is if lifespans continue to expand and there's no sign that they're getting any shorter, in fact, we seem to add about 2 years to 2.5 years to a life of somebody in a country like the United States or a European country every decade, and you take our population right now and you add the same amount of life to a lifespan now, you'll add around 200 billion years of human life that the planet has to support for any given snapshot of the population. So the 7 billion people who live now, if they lived an extra 20, 30 years, they will be living hundreds of billions of extra years on the planet. And we need a way to navigate all of this.
So is there a number which can quantify how much older our world's population is right now versus how old it once was?
Sure. And the median age of the global population is a really great way to do that. So right now the median age of the world's population is around 28. That means half of the world is below 28 and half of the world is older than 28. So if you go back to before the Industrial Revolution, before there were public health regimes, before we defeated infectious disease, you know, the median age of the world was in the teens. You know, the far more young people than there were old people, and people tended to die in the biggest numbers when they were young and when they were in their 40s. By the year 2050, the median age of the world will be 10 years older than it is now. It will be 38. And the vast majority of people who die in the world will be in the upper ranges of the human lifespan, age 60 and older. So young people will not be the people who die. People in their 40s are as robust as they've ever been. In fact, they're doing fantastically well. And then as people die later and later, the age of the world goes up.
One thing that's intriguing about your book is that it is not only a book about how communities age and grapple with sort of this new reality, and nations as a whole need to grapple with it as well. Your book is also, to some extent, about the science of aging and what the aging process is like and how it is different from what it once was.
That's right. And to me, that was a revelation. Doctors know this, I imagine, but I didn't, which was that, you know, life used to be on a kind of on-off switch for most of the world. And you were alive one day, got sick, and 4 days later you were dead. But very recently in human history, you know, really a blip in our 100,000-year run of having societies, life has become a dimmer switch so that our capacities diminish over time. Many of them stay quite strong over time. And this idea of sudden death has really become a rarity. And it's really about managing life over the long run. How do we make the most of it? And mankind's been very impressive in how adaptive it's been. And one of the ways we adapt is by adapting our communities to provide the health care, to train the people who provide us the health care, to create support systems. Even whole communities, as you know, in the book I talk about Sarasota, Florida, there, that is a whole community designed from the ground up in order to make the most of residents in their later life. And, you know, this is a world that we are all walking into. Sarasota seems old today, but we are all going to be the age of Sarasota in the future, all of our communities.
One intriguing line I want you to have a chance to explain, because it sort of grabs us by the throat when we read it. It's how you open chapter 6, Cheating Death One Molecule at a Time. The chapter begins with these words: "We begin to die while still in the womb."
That's right. I mean, there is no escape from the kind of decay that we have over life. It's just one of the things that limits, you know, our biology. So Tom Rando, one of the scientists I talked to at Stanford, you know, is a critic of some of the medicine that people see in the future that might help us live forever, because our bodies are wired so that the genes that help us grow when we're young are the ones that turn against us when we're older. Because, as you know, cells have to thrive just like any living thing. And the reason you get cancer is that they thrive too well. Certain cells thrive too well. So he sees this as a check on, you know, indefinite immortality. But, you know, all of these mechanisms are built into us at the moment we begin to grow. And you know, if you've ever wondered, and in your state I know you have, why some superstar athletes start fading in their mid-20s. It's because some parts of us start weakening even that young. So a NFL lineman coming up at age 19 is in very, very different condition than just somebody in past their mid-20s. Hmm. And this is why the retirement age from professional sports is very, very young. It's a function of aging.
Hmm.
Other things age far more slowly. Our vision ages slowly. Our cognition ages much more slowly. And we can make adjustments by acquiring knowledge over time. You know, NFL players who last the longest tend to be the ones who are cognitively sharpest.
You examine several different nations and a number of different communities. One of the things that caught me a bit by surprise is how much you talk about the nation of China, and also how much you talk about the nation of Spain. And, I mean, those are two countries that we don't think very much about often in the same sentence. But here they are featured very, very prominently in your book, because each of these countries is grappling with this in very, very dramatic fashion. And each also seems to be, at a sense, at a different point in this arc, heading towards a drastically aging population, and of course with very, very different cultures. I wonder if you could compare China and Spain as they confront this reality, and what their struggles have to do, for instance, with the United States.
Sure. Well, I was very interested in both those countries because I thought for us to understand our future, one thing I might do is go to the countries that have aged ahead of us or are on a faster curve towards a more aged society than the United States. Now, China interested me because this was the first place where I began thinking about the relationship between globalization and aging. You know, why are jobs in the developed world for older workers being shed in exchange for jobs for younger workers in China? But then once I got to China, you know, I learned so much about the dynamics of family. So as you know, China's very, very famous and proud of a long tradition of filial piety, you know, the family above all, respect your elders. And yet I found that this is a country that for most of the 20th century has been at war with these values. The government has really tried to rip families apart. It has the most anti-family public policy in the world, which is the one-child policy. It encourages young people to go to cities and leave their parents behind. That's certainly not venerating your elders. And once the families are separated, the children sometimes send money home for a while, but over time, as the distance grows greater and the separation grows longer, the parents are forgotten more and more and abandoned more and more. So I was talking to a professor at Tsinghua University, which is kind of their Harvard and MIT rolled into one, and I said, this is amazing. We all think of Chinese society as is the place where old people are venerated. And she said, yeah, you know, those values grew up when we lived to be 35 and nobody really had to deal with them. But now we're older and they don't hold up so much. In fact, you know, the state is really the enemy of that idea and it's a lot for families to go against. But by the same token, there's a lot of heroism among families that keep them together in surprising ways. And I detail those in the book. And there's some really heartbreaking stories about how older mothers have found their way back into their families and reintroduced the whole idea of family back to them. And then there's Spain, a very, very different place. Now, Spain does not have a one-child policy, but in the last years of the fascist Franco regime, the opportunities for women started to expand, so women could go to school, they could start thinking about the job market. And as a result, they started flooding out of rural Spain. Spain was dominantly a rural society before, and as women and also young men, but most prominently women in this argument, start leaving the country for the city. They put off having children. They get better and better jobs. They get separated from their parents, but ultimately they start bringing their parents to the city, and they bring their parents to the city, and it empties out the countryside almost totally. I went to some villages where there were no young people at all, and there were empty houses because the old people weren't there either. And once the women and men are, younger women and younger men are working in the city and their parents are there, they need people to take care of their parents. So Spain threw open the doors for immigrants, and it went from being a country which had no immigrants at all, virtually none in the year 2000, to being one of the countries in the world with the highest population of immigrants for its size. One out of eight people who lives in Spain today is foreign-born, up from nearly zero. And that's because this is the solution that Spaniards have found so that the adult children can work, the older parents can be taken care of, and the country can enjoy what it's gained, realizing education and aspirations for women, prospering economically. Now it's going through a hard time because of the recession. But the fortunes of Spaniards are far, far different than they were under the regime of Franco, which was so adamantly pro-family that it did, in essence, it did violence to the family.
A little closer to home in terms of our listeners here is the time which you spend talking about Rockford, Illinois, a place I've been many, many times. I know a number of different people from Rockford and knew something about its history, but I actually had no idea that once upon a time, you tell us Rockford was one of the richest 20 towns in America, with perhaps per capita more millionaires than any other comparable metropolitan area. It, of course, is not enjoying that kind of abundance now. But beyond that, you explain some ways in which Rockford is confronting this matter of aging population in some very intriguing ways.
Well, I think this is something that your listeners ought to find very, very close to home. You know, your state is one of the most highly industrialized states in the country. It kind of swaps positions with Indiana for that honor. Lots of family-owned businesses, many of which used to be locally owned but now have been wrapped into giant conglomerates. Many, many jobs that have gone overseas. What's happened in Rockford was it went from being a community that was robust, virtually all of the economic activity that held it together was industrial activity, making the things that go into other things that Americans make. It was the screw capital of the world. And then globalization happened, and jobs could be moved, and factories be made flexible, and machines could replace older workers. And the employers looked around, and through several waves of downsizing, or right-sizing, they like to call it, several waves of that, the older people in town either took early retirement or were just cast out of the factories. And you go everywhere in town, and the retail clerks you see everywhere are older people. And the young people are leaving because, especially the well-educated young people, because they feel the town has really now made people in midlife feel that they're past their use-by date. And I just felt that this was an interesting contrast to Sarasota, which we talked about. Sarasota, because everything in the air in Rockford made you feel you were old at 50. That's just not the way communities ought to be. So the community set about to try and rejuvenate itself, create cafe society, arts organizations, things that would attract the younger Rockfordians back to town and bring in a whole new class of creative people. Well, that hasn't been so successful. What's really brought people into town who are younger is ironically the aging population, because the most active niche in the local economy now is the healthcare sector. And if you go around the hospitals, you see great things. You see cafes popping up. You see nice restaurants popping up. You see young people going around because they've come in to serve the healthcare sector. And in fact, Rockford, one of the big healthcare providers in Rockford, a big hospital group there, sent its executives to the Philippines to recruit 100 young nurses to come to town. And it got a fair number. And now the Filipino families fill a giant church, and they have their own minister there. And you know, interestingly enough, Rockford's finding its new young future because of the older population that has stayed there.
So are there particular ways in which we need to craft our public policy to better come to terms with this new reality? Or can we leave it to, in a sense, the marketplace to sort of take care of this situation and the elderly among us as they grow in numbers? I mean, what do we need to do about this reality, which you point out in your book so effectively?
Well, I think we have to fight for policy that addresses it, but we can't assume that we'll get it. So you need your own solutions as an individual, too, which is all of our responsibilities, too. So on the social side, you know, I do think we need to figure out how we can renegotiate the bargains for public sector pensions, Social Security, health care for the older, so that we can actually save the money we need to save to keep these things viable. So that's a very basic thing that needs to be done. But then we have to think long-term, what do we do to create the best society for all of us in a world where the older population will be an increasingly large proportion of the population? And for me, that means number one, making sure that people have the resources to arrive at a period which we now think of as late life, but where we might start thinking of as late middle age, not yet old age. So right now, the hallmarks for retirement are age 62 and age 65. Wouldn't it be nice if workers felt justifiably that they arrived at age 62 and 65 more valuable than they've ever been before in their lifetimes. That means that they have trained themselves across their lifetimes. I do believe there ought to be government incentives to get people to train themselves and keep their skills up to date as they age. This works in other countries, and the older workforce there is not reduced to lower wage work late in life. They stay active and they stay valuable, and they're worth the high salaries they get. And then for families, you know, we might think about how do you communicate to a younger person that they owe it to themselves to design their life so that they are not, so that they work and are fulfilled throughout most of their life and not idle for the last 30, 35 years of their life. And when you start telling people that, I think one reason people don't save for old age is, you know, there's just the natural inclination not to think about it. But another is, like, it's only 10 years at the end of my life where I'm going to be struggling. What's the big deal? But if you say, no, it's not 10 years, look at the facts. If you reach 50 years old and you're a young person today who will reach 50, you have a more than even chance of living to 100. Do you want to have a life in which you're idle, not working for at least as long as you were working? And I think people will not want that. And we will start planning the course of our life very differently so that we're engaged and valuable. And I think that's something we have to tell our children. It's something we owe to ourselves. And that's what will make a aging society feel like a rejuvenated society.
The book again is called Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nature. The book is published by Scribner. Its author, Ted Fishman. Ted Fishman, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and talking about this very, very intriguing book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
And the time is 8:47. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Well, I am used to books crossing my path and piling up on my desk, but what arrived in the mail the other day was something quite out of the ordinary. At a glance, it looked for all the world like a bag of potato chips. But if you looked a little more closely, even before opening it, you knew it was something else. On the package, it said, Potato Chip Science, Book and Stuff. And below that, explore major branches of science, 29 incredible experiments, physics, biology, chemistry, and earth science. And up at the top, warning, high in saturated facts. And this is the work of Alan Kurzweil and son. They are a father-son partnership, they like to call it, of snack food researchers. And they have cooked up this idea together. And you may know Alan Kurzweil as the award-winning author of Leon and the Champion Chip, Leon and the Spitting Image, The Grand Complication, and A Case of Curiosity. And we're going to find out a little bit about how the two of them, that is father and son, came up with this wonderful idea and created this wonderful kit together, which is published by Workman Publishing. Alan Kurzweil, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg.
So where's your son this morning? Is he doing any of the publicity for this project, or is he busy with other matters?
Currently, it's a holiday at the moment, so he's currently sleeping downstairs.
Ah.
But yes, he is the principal beta taster and beta tester for Potato Chip Science, and he was the one who kicked me in the rump to do something a little bit more user-friendly than the subjects I usually explored, antique pocket watches and the like. He is the potato chip fiend behind Potato Chip Science.
Very good. This is a really interesting mix of ingredients and experiments, and it might be interesting just to begin by explaining to listeners if they get this bag and open it up, what exactly they're going to find.
Okay. Well, what happens is if you walk into a bookstore or you go online and you look at Potato Chip Science, you will be staring at a big honking potato chip bag. You tear it open, as I'm about to do right now, and you dump it out onto the table, and you will find inside a 96-page book, a sound chip that's powered off of a potato, a small propulsion pipe
tube, a clock, again powered by a potato, some optical stickers, an eco-friendly knife, some wire connectors, electrodes, the obligatory googly eyes. You have to have the googly eyes. And
yes,
you basically are introduced to a world of science that exploits the miraculous qualities of America's, and in fact the world's, most popular snack food. So when we were growing up, Greg, we learned about the five branches of science: biology, chemistry, physics, and the like. Well, this book repurposes or reinvents science and gives kids the opportunity to perceive of science as five branches of potato chip science, those being bags, chips, lids, spuds, and tubes. And so using those basic materials that they harvest from the recycling bin, they can learn about biology, or they can learn about Bernoulli's principle. They can build kites. They can build chipmobiles. They can build stomp rockets, all using these materials we usually think of as trash.
I think that one interesting little bit is in the introduction in the booklet, you stop to write a moment about matters of safety, which in some respects is probably enticing for some young people to know that they're doing stuff that they have to be sort of careful about as they do it. I mean, there's just this tiniest little element of danger there.
Well, danger, of course, is an important part of discovery. I mean, where would Franklin have been without lightning striking as close as it did? But, you know, of course, there's the competing impulse to keep things safe. And so all of the experiments in this book were tested rigorously before they made it in, and we took out a lot. My son and I, for instance, had a habit, for research purposes only, of launching a potato about 300 yards using a 6-foot-long exterminator. But obviously we couldn't put that into the kit. So we reduced the scale, and we have a small 6-inch propulsion pipe that really risks almost nothing and teaches kids about Boyle's Law, the inverse relationship of volume and pressure. So, yes, I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had. The kids can carve shrunken potato heads. They can launch the packing peanuts that are inside, the packing chips that are inside this bag, serve double duty as the ammo for the confetti cannon they build. It's all about showing kids that they can learn about science. They can learn about science by making things. They can turn off their computers and their video games and really explore the world around them simply by pulling open the recycling bin or grabbing a few things from the grocery store.
One thing I really appreciate is that there is something of the methodical required for some of this, and even before a lot of these experiments get started. I mean, that we find a spread towards the beginning of the book in which you talk the young scientists through how they can take an empty potato chip bag that they found somewhere and essentially prepare it for the experiments that they can do with it. And that in and of itself is important, not necessarily the sexiest way to spend your time, but it's important. And that's probably a good lesson for a youngster to be learning, that it isn't just about blowing things up in the first 10 seconds.
That's right. Although that moment of blowing things up is crucial, too. I wouldn't undervalue the opportunity to make mistakes and to make a mess and to take things apart. But that's right. There is a measure of rigor that is introduced to the book, but it's done so subversively. It's done with the kids in mind. So, for instance, the system that this kit introduces is called the system. And those four M's are easy for kids to remember, but they are the basic principles that the folks at NASA also use. The first M is materials. You have to know what you need. The second M is method. You have to know how to do it. And the third and most important M is, of course, the meaning. What do you learn? What's the takeaway from blowing things up or from launching confetti cannons or for building a chipmobile? And then finally, the final indulgent M is the little munchies, the little morsels of information that expand kids' imagination. So, for instance, they learn that if you put all the potato chips that we consume in a single year end to end, they would reach from their research facility in their kitchen to the moon and back 23 times.
That really makes you think, doesn't it?
It does.
The various chapters of this book deal with the chips themselves or the lids on the cans or the bags and all kinds of different experiments that one can do, including certain experiments involving the plain old potato itself. Can you just say a word about how these experiments came together? And, I mean, were you sort of blowing things up and trying and failing and in perfecting these experiments to the point where we find them in the book?
Yeah, if you had the misfortune of walking into my basement, well, of attempting to walk into my basement, you would have to navigate around 6 or 7 cases of potato chips, a bunch of sacks of potatoes, about 4,000 chip lids, and a whole bunch of empty bags. And my son and I spent months and months and months cooking up all these experiments, testing them up down in the basement or, when necessary, outside. And so we just did what a lot of scientists do, you know, just trial and error, figuring out how to perfect them, and then, of course, figuring out how to illustrate and communicate them. All of the science experiments, for instance, the materials are always not just listed but illustrated, because some kids may know what an eye screw is. Other kids won't know what an eye screw is, but if you see a picture of an eye screw, you know exactly what you have to rustle up to make, for example, the bird feeder out of a plastic potato chip tube. So it was a long process, back and forth, where language, of course, is important and text is important, but the most important thing, of course, is the fun, the sense of getting kids as excited about science as they are about a bag of potato chips.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention to our listeners, especially for those that maybe don't have young people in the home who might have read your previous books, that it's no accident that what you are focusing on here is potato chips as sort of the medium by which all of this gets done. Explain how this ties into some of your previous works.
Well, I've written a series of children's books with this, featuring this character, Leon. And Leon, like my son Max, loves potato chips. So what started as a very casual interest in potato chips became more and more obsessive in the household. And so by the time I started sitting down to write book two, that interest in potato chips morphed into a scientific curriculum presented by one of the characters in the second book named Franklin Sparks. And he saw that kids were bored to death with the kind of science experiments and lessons plans they had to endure as fifth graders. And he said, okay, guys, what do you care about? Leon, of course, has two of the most magic words in the English language, potato chips. All the other kids go crazy. And Franklin Sparks says in the book, okay, we will study science using potato chips and nothing but potato chips for the next 9 months, and hence the birth of potato chip science.
And it can be yours as well. And again, it's an absolutely wonderful way to get, for that matter, young and old, interested in science in a whole different way. Potato chip science, book and stuff. When you find it on a shelf, it's going to look like a bag of potato chips. But trust me, there's all kinds of great things inside. And A. Kurzweil and Son are responsible for this. It's from Workman Publishing. Alan Kurzweil, what a pleasure to speak with you. I've long admired your work, and this most recent product of your creativity is something very, very special, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Monday on The Morning Show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program to lead a wide-ranging conversation about the importance of STEM, science, technology, and mathematics in education. On Tuesday, our conversations will include one with Frank Almond, the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, who is going to be coming to Carthage College to play a concert. Wednesday, some musical matters as well as we preview the upcoming Florentine opera production of Elmer Gantry. The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Sunshine today and a high up to 29 degrees, overnight low of 25 degrees, and we'll be in the upper 30s tomorrow and Sunday as well. And we're actually likely to see the 40s for a daytime high for early next week by Tuesday or so. Right now, though, a relatively chilly 9 above in Racine and Kenosha. This is WGTD 8.